Welcome to the Spotlight Report, part of Erie Insights, a resource dedicated to discussions regarding optics and science. I'm your host, Logan Graves, at the University of Arizona. Our website is erieinsights.com, where you can find this episode and comment or subscribe. Additionally, you can find our other podcast series, as well as articles and other resources. Our email address is mail@erieinsights.com. We would love to hear from you. Hi, this week on the Spotlight Report, we are speaking with Dr. Hannah Grant, who recently completed her PhD at UCSD with a focus on photonics, specifically on silicon photonic systems. Her advisor and co-advisor at UCSD was Dr. George Papin and Shayan Mukherjee. And we've spoken to Hannah in the past, or pardon me, I should say Dr. Grant, in the past, about some of her research. So today is a really great opportunity because we get to get the entire perspective on her dissertation work. And additionally, we get to hear a little bit about what her postgraduate life has been like. So Dr. Grant, thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so it's a pleasure. So just to start off, can you explain what your dissertation was? The title was Opportunities and Challenges in Silicon Photonic Systems. So what does that broadly cover?
So that's a kind of a broad title name, because sometimes with PhDs, you end up having a lot of work. Some people end up doing one thing that's hyper-focused, and other people end up focused, like having the opportunity to work in lots of important ways, and so you have to somehow bring that together to make a story. And so I continuously was working in silicon photonics, particularly for data center applications. And so that's where the systems is. And though all of those devices may have had different purposes, some were switches, some were doing some other sort of technique, they all kind of underlied on the similar device properties and were built for communication system purposes. So that's kind of where that comes in. The opportunities and challenges is, well, my advisor said, I initially wanted to be challenges in, and he said, never start the title of your thesis on a negative point, which is true. Like, you know, we think in PhD in grad school, like something is not working and we can get so fought up in the negative of challenges. But he was like, you should put opportunities in there. And it's also true is in research is when you identify a challenge, you also identify an opportunity to create more work or a new pathway or what the field can go into more. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of where I start to identify things. And so that's summary of that.
Cool. And just for our listeners who aren't super familiar, photonics probably is dealing with light when we describe it as a photon. Do you want to give a more robust explanation of where silicon photonics specifically fits in?
Yeah, so you are correct that it's now your devices are so small that you kind of have to deal with the light-particle duality of light, mm-hmm. which is inherent to light, but when you have things that are like lenses, or even, you know, when you see light from your lighting fixtures, they're considered more waves because there's so many photons that you can just negate that. And silicon photonics, silicon is just a platform for this. Mm-hmm. Silicon being, and the reason why this is such a big platform for it is because it already levies off of CMOS processing, so how we make transistors. And there's a lot of work that's gone into that, and the idea being that, well, if we go for photonics, we can A, have faster devices, but B, they don't need the level of they don't need to be on the same level of a resolution as a transistor would be to do the same amount of work. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, in that sense, we don't have optical logic, so that's a whole nother story. And I do talk discuss that in my thesis a little bit. But the fact that there are very mature processes that we can levy versus some of the other photonic components, which I now work in a lot more in indium phosphide or in silicon nitride, those are more done in an in-house, or they can be done more in-house as opposed to silicon photonics, where you can just ship it off to a foundry and you get your device back. So similar to like how someone would have a PCB made, you ship it off and you get something printed and it comes back. And that was like the beauty of this idea, is that you could start really doing what we do with circuits now with optics.
Right. And I think that's like the easiest way to describe it, is that it's an optical circuit. So you get the faster communications, lower losses potentially.
Faster routing.
And you move away from these. I think a lot of people don't realize that on these computer chips, we're pushing the resolution down to like a few nanometers.
On this scale, in silicon, you only need like 50 nanometers of resolution, at most. You know, most of these components, width is like 200 nanometers. And so it's a lot more leeway in that sense.
Right. I mean, the single nanometer type stuff that they're pushing towards is really, it's impressive, but depending on who you ask, there's definitely a limit, and the cost of approaching that is going up. So cool. Yes. That probably explains it. What specifically was your project, or what were the sub-projects, I guess, and maybe we can work through those.
Yeah, so I worked on a lot of things. I was very fortunate enough to have already had research experience coming into grad school. And so some of the first publications I was on was literally just go into the lab and help us measure this. So I have publications writing back from when I first started to when I defended, which is great. Some grad students don't get the opportunity, but because I already knew how to do the tedious work of being in a lab. But so that was doing things with a router. So there is a type of data center network where you do add drops. You have different wavelengths, and so each wavelength is going to have a channel. And so the idea being that if you had four filters, you can then drop off four wavelengths, detect their signal, detect what they want to send, and then send back those four wavelengths. So that was one of the first components I worked on. And that was a set of ring resonators, and that's pretty common in silicon photonics to see these components. And next from there, I worked a lot in switches. So I worked on using this IBM switch. It's a 4x4 input and output, so that means that you can put four inputs and four outputs, and then you can switch them, so any which way. I worked on a few different projects for this. I first started out with a novel way, really exhaustively measuring crosstalk. So when you have a large component switch, and just inherent to what is called coupled mode theory, which is how these switches work, you're going to have crosstalk. You cannot inherently isolate one mode from the other when you're trying to move mode, like optical modes around. And so when you start to scale those devices out to say 4x4 or 8x8 or 64x64, or even now we have like 124x124, that's going to have an inherent amount of crosstalk that's going to start to add up. And so what I did with this 4x4 was I was actually one of the first people to exhaustively measure that, and then also measure it using real data. So we looked at data clocking streams with respect to the crosstalk. So clock synchronous or clock asynchronous, meaning that all the data streams for synchronous, they have all been aligned to the same clock. They're all from the same clock. And clock asynchronous obviously means that they're from different, random clocks. And seeing how that adds up, if the data streams and how that adds up and how that affects the interference with the crosstalk.
Right.
And that was kind of a short-lived project, mainly due to the resources and the complicated nature of, I wanted to exhaustively model the crosstalk, and I was kind of told this is going to be, I don't think this is totally worth, it's a very exhaustive thing, and there's a lot of unknowns, and it's a lot of things that you can't necessarily isolate without having more resources. And so, but it was still an interesting project because it did teach me a lot about data center systems, because I was sending in 4 real signals on 10G Ethernet and then detecting them at the same time.
Huh.
And also, then that's not commonly done with silicon photonic devices. Usually people, the device side, people don't measure their components to that degree. They only measure, say, one input to one output. Or they'll measure one input and then another output and get the crosstalk that way. So they do them in isolation and they say, we got this number, it's good enough.
Right.
And when we look at this field that's becoming really mature and we want to use it, and there's a large demand to use it, then we really need to start bridging the gap between, all right, what is the device side, you know, proponents, and how does the device side proponents match up to the communication side proponents?
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. And so that's kind of where that, yeah, sorry.
No, I apologize for interrupting. So what was the result between the synchronous versus asynchronous effect on the crosstalk?
So I think what we saw was that the asynchronous degraded, like, correct me if I'm wrong, degraded more with more crosstalk, so as we added more channels. But I can double check real quick.
And for our listeners as well, we'll link to the paper.
Yeah, and my thesis is published online as well.
Mm-hmm. And right, and we'll include that as well.
Ah, yes. So yes, the asynchronous was worse than the synchronous. The asynchronous was worse than the synchronous, and that was not expected because we thought that due to the randomization of the clocking, that you'd have less interference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm surprised by that actually, but
yeah, that was, you know, these measurements took 48 hours to take, maybe somewhere in the 24 to 48 hours. So I literally started a good night's sleep, and I started at 8 a.m. or something, and I took 8 hours to align. And if I messed up, then I had to redo the whole alignment again. And then once I had the alignment, I had to maintain it all night long, and each data point took about 2 hours. So like, it was like, this is a very tedious project. And while it's worth to have said, I did this and, you know, here's the results, there are also, because I think, like, you kind of get PTSD from doing these type of measures and you're like, I can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, I did a lot more modeling work.
Right. Yeah, I think I've been asked in a couple interviews, what was the hardest thing I ever had to do in the graduate career? And I always talk about the fact that it was aligning a CGH for an interferometry test really precisely and maintaining that alignment. And it just would take hours and hours and hours and hours. And something would go out of alignment and it was like, okay, time to start again.
You're this close to just breaking something and you're like, I just gotta walk away. I have to restart again.
Or yeah.
Maybe get some sleep.
Right.
So I think part of the reason why I was told not to pursue this anywhere was literally just the physical toll.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't really have any help. I should ask maybe for some more help with alignment and those things, but, you know, sometimes you're stubborn like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important thing for people who are considering grad school. I see it a lot with younger grad students is, like, not asking for help, and you can kind of chase things down the rabbit hole too far. Like, you can overwork yourself really easily.
And you get stuck, or you get stuck in this one idea, and you don't even take the moment to step back. And having at least someone to discuss the idea with is important, because it helps you to reflect on, was this a crazy thought I had, or is this actually, like, a developed thing?
Mm-hmm.
Also, because I was co-advised, I really didn't feel, none of my lab mates, my co-advisor, I mostly worked in his lab, they really didn't know what I was working on. And so when it came to me asking, like, for help or reflection, they just thought, like, it was very left field to them. Right. And in general, too, like, some labs, they're really encouraging, advisors are really encouraging of, like, discussing of thoughts, and some labs, like, they're not necessarily as much. It's, you only go to someone if you have a problem. It's, you know, and then back to work. Immediately back to work.
Yeah, I mean, advisors, maybe we can get into this a little bit if you feel comfortable talking about it, but we've talked about with other people that you need to be pretty picky about, if you can, you should be picky about who your advisor is, because they have very different personalities and ways they work. I've talked about it, that Daewook, for myself, you know, if anything interesting happens, he wants you to let him know, and he'll come into lab and look at it, and he's excited. But like you say, other advisors, it's like, why is this not done? I don't want to hear about it till we have the results.
Yeah.
Or I'm just out of town and you won't hear from me for a couple months.
So, you know, I kind of had both with my co-advisors. They both taught me a lot, I think, in how to balance things. And, yeah, I had wanted my first advisor coming in. He definitely was in the lab a lot. But it also meant that our culture in the lab was, there was a lot of pressure to be in the lab and be there. And even if you weren't, like, working on something, or I felt like there are some students that did that at times, and it can create a toxicity, I felt like. And then my other advisor, he didn't really care where you did your work as long as you got your work done. But when he made the time to meet with you, which was near the end of the quarter, and I'd be like, I gotta go, or I'm trying to finish up grading, or like, I haven't, like, he it was like, there was a go time where he'd be willing to meet with you continuously, and then there was a time where it was just kind of like, okay, I'm meeting with you, and I felt like he's got a million other things on his plate, that, like, this meeting was just a repeat of last week's meeting.
Right, not always so, productive, or...
Right, and that's a little, you know, you have a lot of initiative just to say, like, no, we already discussed this, you know, let's move on.
So in my opinion, you made the wise decision and moved towards modeling, as opposed to the, the hardware testing, right?
I mean, I wanted to, so one of the things with testing this component is I realized that when you are trying to test a switch, a large port count switch, it's really hard to know, exactly where things like bias voltages are going to be. So I'm continuously applying them. And I devised a model, which is what I talked previously on, how to assess the voltages and what is the statistical error in assessing these voltages if you had a large port count switch. And it kind of also goes through, okay, where is the likelihood of fabrication errors in these types of devices, and where is, you know, where are the sensitivities that you have to consider when doing these measurements. But more so, I assess that being at a 50-50 biasing point, so the interference between these switches and how they work is a sine squared. Mm-hmm. Sine squared has a really nice portion where if you're at, you know, pi half, yes, the pi half, you are actually in a linear regime. And so if you have a model that's trying to determine what voltages you want to operate at, if you give it somewhere near the, if you build your model based off of those linear regimes, it actually has more information in it than when you're near the peaks, where the deviation away from the peaks is much smaller. So it's more of, think of like the derivation, you know, think of the derivation of a sine. And if you had like a fitting algorithm to your model that you've built, it's trying to step in, and there's less room for the sine squared peaks to. So I built the model, and I showed that this is a more robust choice, and it got accepted pretty fast to a pretty good paper in Journal of Lightwave Technology. That was really easy to get in, but it took me, the final paper took me, I think, over a year to write. My advisor was very nitpicky about things, made me go back and check things. And while that was good and all, it also just took a lot of time. And then the last paper I worked on, which ended up getting rejected, and so we still have to find a time to submit it, or we're still waiting back to hear back from advisors to work on this, and we've been trying to develop it, was on, okay, based off of switch architectures, how can we model switches, and can we come up with a switch architecture? So there are some trains of thoughts when it comes to optical switching or optical architectures. Some of them are, okay, we want a component that's as broadband as possible and can handle any wavelength you want. And you have components that are wavelength specific. So filtering off and et cetera. Both of them have other trade-offs. So ones are much faster than the others. Some are more sensitive to heat than others. And I built a component that was a mixture of both wavelength and spatial multiplexing. So wavelength being wavelength selective and spatial. And I used data that I had from two different types of devices to show that this is a reality that can do. Now, the device itself was not built to be this type of architecture. I actually used two different devices and put them together and showed that this is still a resounding amount, like, because you combining the two, you end up mitigating the amount of crosstalk, but you also balance the amount of tunability. Like, you can levy the two types of architectures to make a more improved switch component. And that was pretty interesting. And it was a lot of modeling work and taking the data and comparing that to the modeling work and showing that this is real. And so we called it a barrel. We called it one of the things I think why I got rejected is because we called it a barrel switcher, which, like, in transistors or in digital, in analogs, they do have these things called barrel switchers. But it's a logic component. This is not a logic component. This is literally just taking channels and going from A, B, C, D to D, A, B, C. It's kind of switching them back, rotating, barrel rotator. And when it's really a fully reconfigurable interconnect.
So
it's just language in that case.
So just to take a step back, I'm going to try to summarize.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. I'll try to summarize. So for the work with switches, the way that it's operating is that you have individual channels which are carrying information, right?
Correct.
And these
different wavelengths.
And these channels they're optical channels, so they're encoded by wavelength. And you want to be able to choose which one you're getting. And like you said, you can filter it based off of what wavelength you might be getting. You mentioned you can filter it based off of spatial filtering, which I think would be based off the modes, right?
Yes. So it would be physically just rerouting the modes.
Okay.
So say you had all of your channels on one bus wave, like one fiber, you could separate them off by wavelength, or you could just move all of those channels together. In general, you'd have to separate them off by wavelength, but some people, they don't, sometimes the wavelength part can be static. And I'm arguing that makes sense. Like, instead of picking off what input you want different wavelengths to go, you can just always say, okay, input one's always going to have wavelength one. So that's a static.
Right. Okay.
Static.
Okay, I see. I'm sorry, the last thing I was going to add is that you also mentioned that for people who aren't in it, all of this light's being carried over some fiber typically, or it could be waveguide, but it's being carried through some material. And the properties of that material are extremely sensitive to temperature, stresses, environment, etc. So that's why you said thermal considerations and stuff, because people want, I mean, fundamentally at the end of the day, I think people can relate to it easiest as, like, people want their Netflix quickly or their internet quickly. And if you have something, and this is,
I mean, anyone who does a quick Google on like cost analysis of a data center, which is how you talk to Netflix and all of those things in our data center, the largest cost is going to be powering it and cooling it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the two largest components. And so, yeah, thermal is a major issue. And silicon, while it's a nice platform in terms of doing thermal, there are thermal switches, like microsecond switches that are just, you apply heat. Those switches can also be sensitive to, all right, are we operating this at room temperature? Are we operating this at 80 degrees C?
Mm-hmm.
Which, in some data centers, 80 degrees C is like, that's not unheard of.
Yeah, I mean, during the, it's probably a little bit harder now, but during the Bitcoin craze, I knew a number of peers who had set up rigs to mine Bitcoin. And if you walked into their room that had the mining rig, it was like, yeah, I get it. I get why data centers are warm, because it can build up heat really quick. So if you don't mind, can we take a step back to your second paper and just kind of step through what was the main challenge that existed that you guys were hoping to solve, and did you solve it, basically?
For the modeling of the... Yeah. Actually, I would say, you know, the main challenge was, can we establish a model that can be a way... The paper actually reads as, like, here's how you would set up this model, and here's how you would assess these devices, and here are the measurements I took to feed into my model, because I did need to take measurements to set it up.
And these devices are the switches?
Yes, they're 4x4... Mach-Zehnder-based switches from IBM that I was lucky enough to have during my doctoral work. And so the modeling work really is based off of, like, okay, can we pick a measurement that has no voltage, so just the base of, like, just quickly put light to the device. And then if we apply light, some voltage to the device, can we then, like, get... what's the least amount of measurements we can get to then set up a model to predict the biasing voltages.
Mm-hmm.
And I even actually, and this is more in my thesis work, I did go in and I had this in my thesis, but I actually started to remove data sets. So at first I exhaustively did, so it's a 4x4. So if you, there are 16 then configurations. So I usually started out with this full 16 to develop the model. But then I started developing the model with 8. And I found that given on, like, just if you pick the lights paths that have the most diversity, so as opposed to picking paths that interfere with similar devices, like, pick the most diversity, you can actually reduce the number of data sets you use and still get somewhat accurate prediction. Now, this is all based off of matrices, and anyone who knows matrices and knows doing matrix transformations, you know that in order to, you know, get A, if you are solving a set of linear equations, you need to have you need enough data to be,
to be able to solve it for the number of variables,
exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Your variable numbers has to equal the number of data inputs that you have. And so my variable numbers, I found that, you know, I started to push that.
Mm-hmm.
How at what point can I start breaking this and have most prediction?
Mm-hmm.
So.
And the paper was accepted, so it was obviously...
Yeah, it went easy peasy.
Right.
It was funny how, while it was accepted, because it took so long, and I just, by the end of it, I was like, I don't ever want to see this paper again. And there was so much that went, like, wrong in the process, and so much, because it's a lot of not just building the model, but did I build the model correctly? Okay, if I'm getting this artifact, am I, like, optimization, it can be a very large unknown, and you should treat it as an unknown in research. Like, you should never say, I trust my model completely.
Which I just want to jump in on that. A lot of people do not do that. I cannot agree strongly enough with that statement, and a lot of research does not act that way.
Yeah. So, well, it helps that one of my advisors is a huge optical statistician. So he's like, okay, statistically speaking, we need to have more values. And the long run idea, if I had more time and more resources, was actually we're going to try and get more components and really soundly test it. It's just once, you know, you measure one, and I think my advisors kind of felt like, okay, well, you can go off and measure 100 devices, but is that really research? And just prove that the model really works, because the next step would be statistically saying this is the exact thing. It helps, though. I mean, it did help me get a job, though, building this kind of model and having that understanding of devices. Because while it's not necessarily research, well, yeah, it is actually, because even when they build data centers based off of, like, when you model a fiber or dispersion in fiber, that's a model that's based off of statistical. Like, they've measured 100 fibers, and they're like, okay, I know this is exactly how the dispersion is going to act. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to build my data center based off of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, sorry.
No. I was going to ask what was the most challenging part, but I think I might hold that until a little bit later on. So moving on, you went to your third paper, which you guys are going to submit someplace, and that mm-hmm. paper was on... Can you give a layman's Sorry. Explanation of what the barrel...
We built an optical barrel shifter, and a barrel shifter is a common circuit component, and literally all it does is take channels A, B, C, and D, and rotates them to be D, A, B, C.
Why?
So you can do a right shift and a left shift. That's a logic. It's in circuits, it's actually a logic shift.
Okay.
So in this case, we thought of it more as an analog shift. Because in optics, and I do go over this in the paper and in my thesis too, this paper's already in there, but unless we get better at nonlinear transformations in optics, there's really no reliable outlet for logic, because we need a nonlinear transformation
mm-hmm.
to do logic. And so that's also another question of, as we go forward in silicon photonics and just in photonics in general, is where should we really heavily utilize optics and where should we heavily utilize electronics? And can you find this beautiful balance between the two?
Right.
Oops, that was weird.
I think I might have lost you.
Yeah, you're back again.
I'm going to call you back right now. Oh,
okay.
No, there you are. Can you hear me again?
That happened to me. Yep. Perfect. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
All right.
I guess the internet slowed down there. So how did you, if you can talk about it, how did you achieve this? Is it all optical or?
Yeah, so this was an all optical component. This is mostly just because we had these two devices in the lab, and research is expensive, and silicon photonic components, more importantly, because they're made at a foundry level, they're pretty expensive, and that requires like a tape out and a 9-month wait time. And I think they kind of just thought, well, let's look at some of the modeling work you've done, and then let's look at the components you worked with, and can we think of something interesting? And so one of my committee members actually brought this up, and he said, this is more of an interconnect, a switch, than it is a barrel shifter, because barrel shifter is inherently in logic. But in some sense, when we have data centers, there is going to be rotational movement between right shift and left shift. So it's more of, yeah, I guess if you had an all optical way of routing light and you wanted to reconfigure things.
Right.
But the idea is that, and the strongest part of the paper, I think, is I discussed the trade-off between, I actually model and compare results to a full spatial switch. So there's a full, this is an 8-channel barrel shifter. There's a full 8-channel spatial switch, And I literally say, okay, given these two components and given their, like, a lot of times in switch topologies, we determine how they scale up. How would these two devices scale up, and what's going to be the weaker device? And I show that this barrel shifter, which is really just a combination of wavelength multiplexing and spatial switching, is a little bit stronger than when it comes to spatial switching. However, I do identify fabrication issues that are issues that we need to address if we really want to make this technology more reliable.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Hmm. So, for your dissertation, it was basically the culmination of all of this, right?
Correct. You kind of wrap it all up and put a pretty bow on it, and you, which is pretty common nowadays, actually. I think there's only one person in my lab who had a thesis that was, you started out one type of device and you finished that device, and that was his whole story.
Mm-hmm.
Some, a lot of people end up working on a lot of different components, and trying to putting something together. And this is sometimes fueled by funding, which is unfortunate, but also can just be, yeah, funding and resources, I think, is.
Yeah, definitely. So, but,
yeah.
So looking back, are there, what's like the most challenging aspect of writing, in your opinion?
Not doing it. Because if you don't do it, it doesn't get done, and then you're like, oh god, I wish I did it.
That's a very, that's a good answer. I like that. Do you have any, like, insight or things that you learned along the way for writing that, short of the answer, yeah, of write?
Actually, I do. So I'm not a good writer. I am an awful writer. I am like the person that ends sentences with prepositions type of writer. So one of my advisors hated it. My other advisor was like, cool, like, you write plain English, but the other advisor was just very much like, you're, for an English speaker, you're like, it has to be more eloquent. You need a theme. You need to tell what is your, and I'm like, oh crap. But I did, I remember I wrote, and this is the introduction to the, so I joined my school, UCSC, for the graduate division, which I always recommend. You always, if you have a graduate division, you know, your student funds go towards that. Use those resources because there's a lot of really cool things they have, but they had, a writing workshop for students to join. And it's pretty much like from Tuesday mornings or whatever morning, it was like Tuesday mornings at 9 a.m. until 1. They lock you in a room, you get as much coffee, and you get free snacks, and it's free. It was free. You just had to put down a $20 deposit, and then you got it back if you did like 90% of the workshops. And then they encouraged people to get up. It was a safe place where you could just get up and go walk around and like take time breaks, and you had other people working in there. So I really liked that. And then they also talked about things like, we did a free write, like did a lot of other things, like starting out with free write, like what our goals are, or what have we read, and we shared goals. It was a very, I think, useful workshop for me to like start really the heavy duty writing process, because from there I ended up writing a lot of my thesis on my own and got a lot of it done in a more effective manner, just really separating out what my goals are and breaking things down. And so I highly recommend if your graduate school has some sort of similar resources, to always use them. They're free, and most of the time people don't use them enough.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, I know that the U of A for the graduate school or the graduate college offers that as well. So, how about in the sense of research design or kind of design of experiment type of thing?
I guess with some of them, it depends. So I had, so for the beta rate one, well, some of the earlier work, it was, a lot of it was picked by my advisor, or it was through a through kind of, and that's really common, is advisors will just give you projects and then they'll kind of let you kind of discuss more if they're a good advisor. So I had the opportunity to discuss more, and I kind of said, like, I think figuring out modeling of these components, or, you know, really making more robust ways of understanding these components to bridge the gap between, like, research and reality would be more useful. And then, so that's where this the second component came in. And then I also, having had worked on various devices, was more interested in looking at switch topology. And then I, with my other advisor, was kind of just, he brought up the idea of barrel shifting, or this component of combining these two and saying, like, we already have these resources, we should use these resources. And so that was kind of, you know, at some point your research, it's not always like it's an idea you have, but you also have an advisor for a reason, to go talk to them and to say, like, I have this idea, or I think this is interesting. And, you know, if anything, if they're a good advisor, they'll work with you and say, like, oh, okay, let's do this then, or, mm-hmm. you know, so.
I just, last night I was talking to my advisor for my final project, and yeah, that's very much so how it went. Was kind of, here's what I think would be a good final project. Here's something that he would say, here's something that you missed. How can we get a workaround? And it is nice, because it, as you get closer to the end of your program, it operates more as a team of equals, it feels like, where you're both kind of not totally certain, and you're both working towards some interesting project, so.
Yeah, I definitely felt like near the end, I was much more comfortable with my advisors. I was very nervous, I think, initially, and was really had a hard time communicating. And near the end, I got very comfortable with them. And that also really helped me transitioning to the workforce, too, where initially I was kind of hesitant, but then I realized, like, we're all here trying to get something done. Like, my boss, like, we have a matrix system at my work, so, like, pulling the boss or the CEO aside and being like, we need to discuss this now, is not uncanny. And, you know, getting that out of your system, getting the jitters of that out of your system in grad school is really good.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yeah, I was terrified of my first advisor, who was Jim Burge, and then definitely nervous with interacting with Daewoop for a while, but no longer. So beyond that, is there general advice that you have, just kind of looking back on grad school, for students, or like, if you were to do it again, are there things you would do differently?
I would definitely suggest, so this isn't always something that's communicated to students, which is your first year, like, you have classes, but as a PhD student, you should also be, like, heavily mining funds from, like, there are a lot more resources for applying for proposals then. And I came in and was told, there's already a project that we have funding for, we want to put you on that because you'd be great starting off in it. And then that project ended up losing funding later on. And so, like, I always suggest anyone who started out, just mine proposals and resources. Just in that first year is really important, because there's a lot that only are granted the first years that are, they'll hopefully carry you. And get more sleep, I guess. I don't know.
I think that is a very good piece of advice. How about, like, culture, or like interfacing or interacting with peers?
Yeah, that can be hard. I struggled with that in grad school a lot. I didn't really fit in with any group. You know, I was one of few American females in my program. And it's really, I mean, on one hand, it was challenging, but at the same time, it's also probably good, because you learn to be patient with others and learn to really kind of take a step back and just say, like, does this matter? And you also learn to, like, go out into the world. Like, I had a community outside of school as well that I really enjoyed. So going to yoga and doing things that weren't necessarily grad school related. Mm-hmm. That also meant that sometimes I think pulling yourself away from the lab and anyway, that was difficult. But near the end, I definitely had a really strong, I had a good group of friends, I thought. You know, I was really heavily involved with a lot of the grad community events, and, you know, I helped put on seminars, and I helped with the women in DC. I helped create that group, and putting on seminars that way. And while I felt like a lot of grad students didn't feel like, they thought, okay, we should either be studying or working or getting free coffee. And so they come to events, get free coffee. And then at the end of the day, like, having said I did a lot of these things or I won some community service awards for doing these things, yeah, it took, like, an afternoon of my time. But it didn't, like, does make a lot more sense when, like, employers are looking at you.
Mm-hmm.
It helps a lot.
Yeah.
But near the end, I did have a lot of people come up to me and say, thanks for always being so nice to me.
And I'd like to get into that too. I mean, you have a perspective a lot of our guests that we interview usually don't have, which is that you've gone through the interviewing process, you've been hired and working now. So, what advice do you have for the interviewing process?
Just put yourself out there. Really, that, like, I made one of my advisors told me, like, start looking now. It could take 6 months to a year because there's so much traveling you might do at one point, and that might take time away from your research. So definitely push that as soon as possible. Anytime you go to a conference, even if you're early on, get cards. Just go on Vistaprint, pay $10. I made fake UCSD ones. They worked great. I just copy and paste the UCSD logo. And then, I have a bunch of, you know, I had a bunch of business cards that I could pass out.
Mm-hmm.
But that helps a lot to remember, for people to remember who you are. I made a website, which really helped too, because it was like a big overarching of all of my TA skills, all of the projects I worked on, all the publications I've been on, as well as personal things. And so it was a really nice summary. And I got a lot of compliments on that during the research process, or during, like, the interviewing process, actually. A lot of people, you know, would come to me and say, I really liked your website. It had gave me a really good idea of who you are as a person. Which,
and did you just...
Yeah.
Just, like, a straightforward type website? Like,
yeah.
Okay.
It's a Squarespace. You could get I got a discount through UCSD, and I was like, all right, I'll pay for it for the year. But I guess so. I was really lucky enough to be part of this multi-university center that was funded through NSF, and they did throw together, like, workshops for the students to learn things. And one of them was... It was this actress who did workshops for STEM students. And so, like, how to, like, carry yourself, how to give a professional talk. But one thing she brought up was branding. And with social media and the internet, like, so much, like, you got to brand yourself. And so I just thought, okay, I'm just going to start branding myself. And slowly but surely, like, that really helps to get your name known. And it's work, but it's, yeah, just think of this. I thought of myself as photonics girl.
Right.
You just go with it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people talk about, you always hear it anyways, that networking, like, that's the number one thing to do. And at least for myself, it didn't come intuitively to me. It kind of took some effort, but yeah, in hindsight, I think it is super valuable.
It's really important. I've also had instances where, like, I am trying to network with someone and they're just not having it. It's like, and, you know, whatever. Meh.
Yeah, there's a little lost, right?
They're a little lost, but yeah, it does help. It, you know, and also being able to, like, be a genuine person helps too. You know, I hate to say that, but yeah, like, all of those things help. I think we get so scared in the engineering community or in the STEM community of, like, oh, this person is, like, 60 years my senior and they're so cool and they've done all these things. Oh, how will I ever be as cool as them? And you realize they were probably in your shoes at one point.
Right.
And they're just human and we're all just human. And so that,
yeah.
That whole helps me a lot to like talk to people and network. It's supposed to, yeah. So
there was, I just went to a talk by Jim Wyatt, who for people in the optics community, he was the dean of optics. He's made a lot of very large, generous donations to the College of Optics at the U of A, I should say. And he also has had a bunch of companies and is just a very well-known name. But he was explaining that when he first got started, maybe he was just being nice, but he was saying basically like he had the exact same amount of knowledge as you or I probably have, and was describing having the same feelings of like, you know, like you come out of grad school and you think you're really, really good at one thing, and you pretty quickly realize you might not be as good as you thought, and you certainly aren't all that amazing at all the other fields of optics. So, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But for the most part, I mean, even when you do a postdoc, it's totally not uncanny when you do a postdoc that they don't expect you to be in the same field. Mm-hmm. It's just they might think that your knowledge base might add to something. And the same thing with my workplace. I actually am working on a lot of other things that I never even touched in my graduate career, but I still find very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was some like learning up time and that I was able to be resourceful, but like I've never had to I design lasers now. I did design lasers in grad school. Like,
Right.
Like, completely different thing, but, you know.
So can you talk about that, I guess, obviously without giving specifics of your work.
Proprietary knowledge.
right. But can you just broadly talk about maybe what skills you get to carry over, or what skills you see as valuable for learning and developing to carry over into the industry?
So the one thing that was really valuable, and right away I was thrown in, I do a lot of design work, which, given my title is now a photonics device scientist, and we only have so many of those. We have a lot of device engineers and test engineers, but so yeah, I do a lot of design work, which is good because I mean, shared a company doing that, I think that's a good place to be in. So right away, I was the first week I was modeling, and I'd done a lot of modeling work in Lumerical, which is a really common software that we use in photonics for modeling components. And yeah, I just jumped right in doing that. And like a lot of planar light wave components. So just anything that's just like a passive component, I started modeling in, because it's like I already knew a couple mode theory. I could just start applying this, or I had similar background in that. But I've also moved in towards, and this isn't like, I mean, this is more of a, like, what I do, the, like, structure and the laser itself. So when you have a semiconductor laser, you've got, like, a band gap, and looking at the band gap, the materials and their band gaps, and assessing, like, the quality of that and looking at that design, which is something I haven't really touched since undergrad, to be honest. Like, I took some semiconductor physics classes and grad school, but silicon, with these components, you treat them as fairly, because you're in IR, you kind of just treat it as an optical window. Mm-hmm. So that's been really interesting, and I've been doing really well on that, actually. I didn't think I would be, but I've picked up modeling in that work and assessing that work, and so I've kind of taken over that role in the company, which is also really cool.
It's astonishing how effective the PhD program is at totally destroying the self-esteem of students, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I was told good job, and I was like, what?
Yeah, you're cringing down, like, expecting for it to be bad news or something.
Like, yeah, I had my first review, and I was like, oh god, they're gonna say, you should be working on this more, you need to get this done, and they're like, no, you've been doing... But, like, at a company, like, it's different. Like, they don't expect you to magically get things done, but at the same time, you're all getting things done for the common good. And another thing is, our company, we've got a lot of work to do. And we've got a lot of, we got when it's a small company, so there's only so many people that can do the work. And so there is a reality of, like, getting quality work done, which is really fun.
Mm-hmm.
And like I mentioned, it's a matrix system, so it's kind of like grad school 2.0, where they pay you better and treat you better, but you still get to do a lot of research and
right.
have fun doing it.
Yeah, Dr. Koshal, the associate dean at the College of Optics, I remember his perspective was that the PhD, his outlook was the PhD was basically a method of demonstrating that, like, yes, I am competent in broadly in the field of optics, for example, and more so, I'm competent at being able to figure out problems. I don't know. Do you agree with that? Or
yeah.
Okay.
I agree. And just applying yourself. Like, there's so much self, like, studying and self-work that you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
But now, when I'm told, okay, this is a thing we need to look into, it's fairly non-trivial for me to, like, start motivating myself to try other new projects and solve them. Or even coming up with new outlets of, what are the questions we should be asking, too. That's probably the strongest skill that you'll learn in your PhD. That's also the strongest skill that's going to make you better than someone it's a worthwhile skill to have.
Definitely.
I think.
So broadly, where do you see the future of photonics, but I guess specifically kind of silicon photonics going?
It's going to be everywhere. I kid you not. I mean, like, well, I can name at least, like, 10 startups in silicon, not 10, but, like, there are a lot of startups in silicon photonics coming out right now. And there are still major issues that the field's heavily pinpointing on. Plus, you also have you have IBM and Intel both. I mean, we already have silicon photonic components coming to market, through transceivers, and so those are starting to trickle into the market. And so now it's a question of, okay, what other components can we start making marketable?
Mm-hmm.
And sooner or later, we're going to have, a large set of, we're going to have a lot more optics than we have electronics in some of our data centers. But, I think, we're still going to heavily go in this way. And there's other fields too outside of data centers. So, like, LiDAR. LiDAR is going to become a big one. I think there's a few on AI, so using silicon photonics with AI, I haven't looked too much into that.
I know that there's that research article out of UCLA that did, like, a optical neural network. So I don't know.
Also going to be big too.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, like, optical neural network thing and applying that to silicon photonics? Those are all hot things. I think the thing that's going to come first is going to be LiDAR with silicon photonics. That's going to be the easiest thing. Like, we'll have that. I'll have LiDAR chips, I think, in the next 5 years at least. I mean, there's so many companies working on this right now. You've got a lot of companies working on it. And then you've got...
A lot of money.
Yeah. I mean, automated cars... I think that'll be the way of the future. And then you've got other components that we're looking at too.
Mm-hmm.
But
so do you, do you prefer or enjoy industry more than graduate school, more than academics, I guess, is a better way to phrase it?
Well, I didn't want to continue in academics. I just didn't see myself as a professor. But I did want to continue doing research. And I also felt like I needed to learn a lot more. Like, with grad school, there's so many resources and it's pretty limited. And I was looking for a company where I got to enjoy working. And the thing is, my company, I think we have a really strong social network with people, which really helps at the end of the day, like, coming to work and enjoying it. And you've got bosses who are excited to work And so, and people take a lot of ownership of their work too. And so, like, I really enjoy the decision I made, but at the same time, I'm learning things. We still publish papers at our company. So it's not like I'm fully removed from academia. It's just, I'm making it, making a decent income, and I get to enjoy, you know.
Well, I think that's really important too for our listeners, and especially the ones not, who haven't finished yet, to hear, is the idea that, like, you can still do research without being in academics. So
it's just, you can't say everything that you work on.
Your research papers
have, it'll be proprietary knowledge, but, you know.
I mean, there's trade-offs no matter what, so.
Yeah. You can, yeah.
Yeah, so cool. Do you have any last words or thoughts you'd like to add?
Nope. I think you picked my brain enough.
You, after defending your dissertation, you're over having people question you about your work.
Yeah, it's proprietary knowledge.
All right, well,
it's fun.
So this week, we had Dr. Hannah Grant. Thanks again for talking to us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
The Spotlight Report. If you would like to comment or subscribe on today's episode or access more episodes of The Spotlight Report, please visit us at areainsights.com, where you can comment and subscribe and additionally access other resources that we provide, such as alternative podcasts and articles, etc. Thank you for listening.